Order. Open the work session on Senate Bill 1000.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and let him do just a brief.
Okay. Mr. Chair, SB 1000 allows two individuals to enter into a valid fiscal beneficiary relationship. The amendment to the bill replaces the amendment and provides for some beneficiary law will allow any two single adults, including unrelated adults of the same gender. This measure makes available to people who cannot marry each other some benefits that previously were available only to married couples.
Mr. Chair, I move the A-10 amendment into SB 1000.
Representative Boquist has moved the A-10 amendments into Senate Bill 1000. Discussion on the amendment.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this amendment would be a great addition to the original Senate Bill 1000, it would be just an additional, like a stuff, not a gut and stuff. And I was certainly hoping that we would be able to have the original Senate Bill 1000 come to the floor so we could have the vote on it. And with this amendment, I will not be able to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, likewise, I cannot support this amendment because it removes the text of the existing Senate Bill 1000. This is certainly one of the most important policy bills that has been introduced into this legislative session. I think it's really important to have the fullest and most open debate on it, and we really need to have that in a policy committee, which is what this committee is. And I think we've done very good work here and under very time-pressured circumstances in the last several weeks, but I really think there's a very significant content in the existing bill, and before we just remove it and put in other text, I think we should be having that full debate here, so I will be opposing the amendment.
Okay, any further discussion on the amendment? I have two that object and three that are okay. The amendment's approved in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move we refer SB 1000 as amended with the A-10 to Budget Committee without recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1000A as amended to the Budget Committee without recommendation. Discussion on the motion?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'm going to be voting no for the same reasons we just stated.
Likewise, Mr. Chair, that this is the policy committee. The Budget Committee is not a policy committee. I think that those roles have gotten confused in this session in a way that I think is inappropriate. And I think runs the risk of damaging the process over the future. We should really maintain a clear distinction between the budget process and the policy committee process. So I will be opposed to the motion.
You know, we had quite a debate even on 3476 when we had that 6 hours. About half the testimony received really wasn't on 3476, and I allowed all of the testimony that came in with no hesitation, with no time limit hardly at all. From the Senate Bill 1000 people, and allowed them to really talk more about that than they did 3476. And it is a very emotional, principled position that people had, and I've tried to respect that position. But at some point, I guess we have to make the decision as to what policies we're going to move and what we're not. Would you call for the vote, please?
Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1000, as amended, moves to the Budget Committee without recommendation. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1000. I want to move that statute out of here yet. She's not here yet. So I'll call. Let's see if Patty Smith's around. Well, I want to get her up as soon as we can.
I'm 3507.
We can go ahead and run a bill or two until she gets here.
Okay. We can skip that one. Are you ready for
this? Okay. I told the VA people to be here at 1.
Okay.
118.
153. We're done.
Patty Smith.
I got four in my mouth.
Chair.
I do.
What do you call it? Life for a woman. Everybody's
in. That's my
Chardonnay? Yeah. Give him a case of that or some type that he gets himself. If you want to go, I got some. I don't drink.
I'm not sure on the feds. I've been working on the recent research of different cases. Two directors briefly.
I'm sorry, Mr. Benson. I believe we still have the last one.
One question.
We'll get the answer. Let's do 453 and get it done.
Well, okay. It's just the result of their control of the process.
So would I. I mean, I didn't understand that's what you were saying. So, and I admitted to her that I didn't understand it. I apologize, and we'll go.
We will seek the VA's on this one.
And the defendant will look at the prescription, therefore.
Are we ready?
Would it really be prohibited?
Yes.
Yeah.
I got it.
Open a public hearing. In fact, I just kind of invited testimony to Senator Metzger on our work session on Senate Bill 153.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. I had spoken to the chair yesterday. I'll be brief but be open to any questions you may have. I know at least part of the committee, as they were formed in the Judiciary Committee, heard this bill earlier this session. Senate Bill 153 is designed to conform all jurisdictions who currently use photo radar and photo red light to adhere to the same statutes that this legislature has enacted. Specifically, it was introduced as a result by the city of Beaverton, who was interpreting the statutes differently than all the other jurisdictions who were using photo radar. I think a lot of you may have read some of those stories. I heard from business folks, I heard from judges, and other individuals who felt that the city was violating the law. And as a result, when I heard a few of those things, as chairman of the Interim Transportation Committee, I asked legislative counsel if the city of Beaverton's interpretations were correct. In fact, Janet Atkins was instrumental in that correspondence. And legislative counsel clearly said that the city of Beaverton was overstepping the law, and they insisted on doing it anyway. So Senate Bill 153 simply conforms and makes very clear what the legislature says they can and cannot do. Specifically, there's two major parts of the bill. Number one, it says that those who are cited under photo radar or photo red light cannot be required to go to court to file a certificate of innocence. The statute clearly says they can respond by mail by sending their driver's license, and that must be dismissed if, in fact, that individual is not the person in the picture. And the city of Beaverton was requiring people to come to court. Beyond that, they were requiring, in order to dismiss the ticket, they were requiring that even if they determined that it was not the individual in the picture, that unless they personally identified the individual and their driver's license of who was driving the car, that they would not dismiss the ticket. And the law does not allow them to do that. This legislation clearly points out that the ticket has to be dismissed if the certificate of innocence is provided. The second provision, and again, these are just clarifications, because I must say all the other jurisdictions who testified, Newburgh, Medford, Portland, all said they understood the law and they conformed. The other one was that there were reports that in using the photo radar van, that in some cases that photo radar van was set up after they went through the photo radar zone. The statute says that they must be notified between 100 and 400 yards, and it was assumed by most reasonable people that means 100 to 400 yards before you get into the zone. But since they didn't say that, the city of Beaverton at times would put up the van warning you of the photo radar zone after you went through it. So the legislation now says it must be before and 100 and 400. And finally, Mr. Chair, also reports to the Legislative Assembly the tools and the procedures that each jurisdiction is using on photo radar and photo red light so that the legislature will have an opportunity to look and make sure that they are conforming to what we intended. And that's the summary, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I think maybe I'd like in a moment for Representative Barker to comment, but
the reason we decided to hear this bill, and it took a little doing, Senator, to make sure it happened. There was some resistance in certain circles. I think you understand that. I think the integrity of the police can be jeopardized by policies of mayors and city councils if they decide to start and go down that track. And I think it brings credibility back to the conduct and of fairness and forthright conduct. I want to make sure that that's put on the record, that that's one of the reasons this is being done. We don't want to put our police in positions of doing that sort of thing or teaching younger officers that kind of conduct. I guess you'd almost call it bullying the public. To me, it's not acceptable. Representative Barker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the I've talked to the city officials in Beaverton about that. That part of Beaverton is in part of my district. And the chief of police, everybody's agreed that they're going to abide by the rules now and the mayor. So I think this is a good move. And are you ready for a motion on this?
Sure am.
Actually, I had a question that I wanted to ask of Senator Metzger, if I could. Just focusing on one aspect of the bill, the prior law, I mean, you commented on this, was that the sign had to be, prior law says, no closer than 100 yards and no further than 400 yards from the location of the unit. Mm-hmm. And now the change would say between 100 and 400 yards before the location of the photo radar unit. And I'm just curious about putting into law now an explicit requirement that the signage has to be in advance, and if the purpose of speed control, whether it's photo radar or the police officer who's conducting it, is to try to deter people speeding generally, I mean, then why a requirement that we tell people before they arrive at the point where they could be ticketed that photo radar is being conducted? It seems to me we're seeking to penalize not speeding but inattention to signs. Because what driver who sees a sign saying photo radar is conducted ahead would then continue to speed?
Well, I think probably the best one to perhaps answer that would be Representative Krieger and Representative Barker, who've had experience in their police work. But you know, my general feeling on that, and certainly in testimony on this bill on the Senate side, the idea of photo radar and photo red light, as it was presented by those who have initiated these programs, is to change behavior. And if you see a sign that says this is going to be enforced, the idea is, if it's not to collect a fine, the idea is to protect the public, that you will slow down. And I, you know, in some police jurisdictions use cars in the past without police officers in them because of the effect of slowing down traffic. So if the warning allows people to slow down, then that actually accomplishes the public safety goal. If they don't, then, you know, they're going to get a ticket for that, but the goal is to protect the neighborhood, not just to have them speed through and get a ticket, because then the damage would have been done if somebody actually had been injured as a result of that speeding. I mean, that's how I would interpret that.
Follow up if I could, Mr. Chairman. Would it make sense then, on that same theory, to require any time that a police officer is conducting speed control with a radar gun, to require a sign 100 to 400 yards in advance of where the police officer is situated? Wouldn't it make sense to do the same?
Well, I think, Representative McPherson, you know, I'd be happy to talk to you about that next session on some other issues that might be related to that. I think that would be an interesting discussion, but I don't think it would in any way impair what we're trying to do with this. You might make it applicable other ways in other places, and I think that would be a great discussion. I'm sure we'd be happy to do that in transportation and next session if you'd like to present something like that.
Well, we have a bill before us today that is making a change in the law, and I'm just trying to understand what's going on with it. And when I see that, it's a requirement that as to one kind of technology, if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd just pursue this line. We have two kinds of technology that we use to catch speeders. And one form of technology we've hamstrung by now explicitly requiring that we tell people in advance that that technology is in use. And we have another technology, which is a much more expensive one, which is a police officer holding a radar gun, and we don't require the advance notice of it. So it, in effect, to accomplish the speed control mission, which is what we're trying to accomplish to enhance public safety, we've made it so much less effective in terms of its impact on the traveling public in this technology as compared to the traditional technology. I don't know, I've yet to hear a good policy rationale for it.
Well, my only reaction to that, Representative, would be, first of all, we're not changing the law. What this is doing is actually confirming the law that already exists that one jurisdiction has decided to interpret differently. We've already made a policy decision when this was first instituted that people have to be notified, that the van has to be notified, that the jurisdiction outside has to have overriding signs, that when you enter into the city of Portland or Beaverton, that photo radar is enforced. So those policy decisions have been made. Senate Bill 153 simply clarifies it for one jurisdiction who has interpreted it differently. What you're asking about is should we have additional policy requirements and discussions, and I would certainly be open to that. But Senate Bill 153 is very narrowly crafted simply to interpret what has already been placed into statute.
Mr. Chair, if I could. I have to disagree with you. I mean, there would be a good policy rationale for the old language, which is that sign be no further than 100 yards or 400 yards from the location of the unit for it to be following. That is, a person who encounters photo radar, and I thankfully never have, but those who tell me that they can see a flash, and that so they might wonder, well, what the heck was that? And then it will be explained to them when they see the signage then down the road. So what the existing statute, to my mind, makes sense, and the revision kind of clarifies, if you will, where that is in relation to the unit in a way that I think alters what the law is now, and I think to the worse. That is, I think for people to, I mean, the reason we have signage up in at the border of the city saying photo radar is enforced is to alert people that there's another technology that's available to control speed. So people are on notice that there's photo radar that's in use. And then to require that they be informed that there's photo radar just ahead is basically to emasculate the use of that technology.
No, I guess that's a philosophical difference, Representative McPherson. I think the photo radar vans are moved around the city because generally neighborhoods request them because they feel that people are speeding through their neighborhood. So if you get people with tickets, they've already gone through the neighborhood, they've already speeded, you haven't changed what the neighborhood is concerned about, which is slowing down traffic. And the notification tells people that the reason we have a photo radar van ahead is that we want you to go slower than what you have done. And understandably, most citizens, I think, when they see that, will slow down. And that is the objective, is to reduce the speed of traffic, not simply to put money into the coffers of a jurisdiction.
I would suggest if we went back and probably looked at the testimony. I don't recall any testimony. I wasn't here listening to it, but there was a lot of resistance to the photo radar to begin with, and there were some sideboards on how you operated it, and that the public had an opportunity probably to have some forewarning, and hoping that, as you said, it would, by visually seeing the warning signs, slow them down. And those who really didn't pay any attention to it then would have the opportunity to go tell someone why they didn't read, didn't see it, or didn't understand it. Anything further on the bill?
I'm ready to go
next. Do the motion.
I just will say that I think you're correct that there was a lot of discussion earlier when the law came about, and there was a lot of input originally. Anybody could sit in the van. They required to actually be a certified police officer and so on.
Well, I understand that there's a general discomfort with the use of this technology, and it tends to be true whenever there's a sort of an advance in technology. There are people who are accustomed to being done the old way. You know, originally speed enforcement was done with a pursuit vehicle, where you kind of an officer had to clock how fast a person was going based on how far their car was going when traveling at the same speed. And we started using a radar gun, which is a new technology that a lot of people thought was not appropriate, and people got their radar detectors and so on. And now we have yet another technology, and yet we've hamstrung it in significant ways, and particularly a requirement that we put out a sign just in advance. I mean, what we are doing is we're not controlling speed. We are controlling how attentive people are to signs. Because who's going to speed if they see photo radar unit ahead? makes no sense.
I think the people that speed or careless drivers aren't paying attention to what's going on around them, and I want them to slow down too.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 153 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker has moved Senate Bill 153A to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion?
Just one comment regards similar to what Representative McPherson did, the opposite side of the fence. It's, you know, being in my line of work, which is well beyond what police officers do, I have a general paranoia of technology that you don't tell public about. And anybody that doesn't understand that, read the entire body of the Patriot Act, and you'll get paranoid very quick of what they can already do to your phone systems and other things. So I think we, as a policy, have a, at this point, have a responsibility to let people know that we're using technology to watch them. Because, yes, we're catching speeders, but we're also 99% of the people are doing legitimate, you know, law-abiding actions, and we are photographing them, too.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Bolquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senator 153 moves to the floor of the due pass. And Representative Barker, would you carry?
I will, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to move ahead. Is Representative Smith here? Okay, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3507.
Okay.
Hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill, House Bill 3507. Cameron.
Thank you. Chair Krieger, I'm Representative Patty Smith, District 52. I'm here today to present 3507, and I have with me Representative Cameron and C.W. Jensen, who have also worked on this bill. And I know it's late in the session. I just want to tell you a little bit about why I want to do this bill, and I want us to do it this session. Because of the high-profile cases that we've had in Florida and Idaho recently, and many more you're going to hear about, I'm sure, but I just feel that we have to do something in Oregon to bring our statutes in line to make sure that this doesn't happen here. And so my whole goal is to protect our children and to protect them now. So I'm bringing 3507, and Representative Cameron has some amendments to it to narrow the scope of it, but I think we have an obligation as a policymakers to do something on this level to bring Oregon more in line with other states to make sure that this doesn't happen here. So with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Cameron to make a few comments.
Representative Cameron, give me just a second. I had failed to let our staff kind of talk a little bit about the bill and also the amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 3507 comes to you from Representative Smith. It increases mandatory minimum sentences from 100 months to 300 months in prison and extends period of post-prison supervision form, requires active tracking of a person convicted of rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, and unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree. You have before you the Dash 1 amendments. The amendments, if adopted, replace the bill. It increases the mandatory minimum sentence for rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, and unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree only if situations where the victim is under 12 years of age. It excludes from the mandatory minimum sentences the increases if committed by defendants under 18 years of age. It establishes authority for lifetime supervision and requires active tracking of persons on post-prison supervision.
Okay, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Chair Krieger and members of the committee. I'm here before you today because just of the events that have transpired. Representative Kevin Cameron, District 19. Thank you, Representative Smith. I'm here before you because of events that have transpired that have been obviously brought to all of our attention in the media and through other public exposure. But more recently, I was at a neighborhood association meeting, and one of my constituents brought to my attention how weak our laws were in this area of the sexual assault and on minor children, and some situations that he had brought to my attention. I went back and started researching what was going on, and realized that Representative Smith had put this bill together and said, "Well, let's see what we can do to make this thing work." I would like to maybe make the statement that we could call this the Oregon Child Sexual Assault Protection Act. What we did with this bill that was already put here before you, 3507, was to really focus it, make the amendments that it focused specifically on those three crimes that were done to our children that are under 12 years of age. Currently, the minimum sentence for somebody who commits one of those crimes is 100 months or 8.3 years. What this bill would do is two things: increase the sentence on somebody like that to a 25-year minimum, 300 months, up to life. Obviously, that's already in the statute. And then require a lifetime tracking upon the release by electronic devices. And I just think that this is a policy that the people in the state of Oregon, we need to do something as these predators continue to go wherever the seems like the laws are weakest. These types of people will know that, and they'll come to our state. So with that, that's pretty much a background on why we're here today about the bill.
Okay, I think.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm C.W. Jensen. I'm a retired Portland police captain. I do live in Portland still. I am a parent. One of the reasons I came down today is to support Crime Victims United. I was hired with the police department, just to give you some background, in 1978. I was a patrolman. I was involved in a shooting with a man that had taken a hostage, armed robber, in 1985. I was promoted to detective in 1985, then later lieutenant and captain, and I retired last year with 26 years. My time in detectives in homicide is one of the reasons I came down here today. In 1989, I was the lead investigator in a case where a young boy was abducted from a schoolyard in Portland. That boy's name was Lee Isley. He was 4 years old. He was taken to Vancouver, Washington by the suspect, Wesley Allen Dodd, sodomized, died from ligature strangulation, and his body was dumped by Vancouver Lake. You may remember the case. He then went on to try to kidnap a child in a theater in Camas. Police took him into custody, and after we had interviewed him for several hours, he finally did confess not only to killing Lee, but killing two little boys in Clark County. Clark County detectives actually had gone on another, they thought they had a suspect, but we found out that our guy had killed all these boys. Wesley Allen Dodd had a history of abusing boys and for his whole life. And I think that as I have looked, as I worked homicide and did cases like this, his story was very much similar to other sex offenders. They start out and they have a continuum that becomes more and more violent. In this case, he told me that he found that killing was even more exciting to him than the rape and abuse of these children. He had been arrested before in Washington for sexually abusing young boys. And the laws at that time were kind of lame up there in Washington, and so some felonies were reduced. And so the end result was he slipped through the cracks and three little children were killed. I have seen this over and over again. Every time we see in the television or newspaper reports in Oregon, around the country, where you see someone has kidnapped, killed a child, you can guarantee they have done it before. To some degree, they have abused other people. I would submit that Brooke Wilberger, the individual responsible for her disappearance, has been arrested before for a similar type crime. These things are going to continue to happen over and over and over again, and that's why I took time out from my day to come down here, because I am a parent, and I've worked with children in schools, and I'm very concerned that this is a big loophole, and this is a great way to grab these people as they are getting worse and worse and worse and putting them away. And so I'm not an expert. I don't think there's any lawyer who's an expert on these guys. I don't think there's any psychologist or psychiatrist that are experts on these guys. But Wes Allen Dodd looked me in the eye, and he told me, there is no way I can change. If I'm ever let out, the first thing I'll do is rape and kill children. And I guess that's the most honest thing that he ever did, was give me that kind of advice, and I've carried that with me. And he just had the guts to say what all these sex offenders won't say. Because burglars, robbers, dopers, they'll all talk about their crimes. Even murderers. I've arrested 50 murderers probably in my career. They'll talk about their crimes, but sex offenders live in secrecy, and that's why they keep getting away with this kind of thing. And so I certainly support this bill, and if you have any questions, please ask me.
Committee members have some questions of the panel?
I have some questions for counsel, actually, rather than the witnesses.
Okay. Are you going to be able to stay through your bill here today?
Sure.
I believe Mr. Taylor would like to talk to at least the two of you for a few minutes. He has a couple ideas that might expedite and improve this. So we'll get the rest of the testimony. If you could meet with him when we're done, that would be beneficial.
That'd
sure.
Be great.
Before you leave, I just say briefly, CW, I want to thank you for coming down here. Of course, we worked together over the years, and I know how very difficult that case was on you personally. And I appreciate you bringing it back up again. I know how tough that is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to close and say that I think we need to do something in Oregon. I think we need to do it now, and this bill is a way to do that. I hope we can find a way to get this through the system now.
We'll try.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. As I said, the Oregon Child Sexual Assault Protection Act, and one of the things that came out of Florida was Jessica's Law. We don't want to have to name it after somebody.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Hummel and Andrea Meyer.
Good afternoon. My name is John Hummel. I'm an attorney from Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Andrea Meyer with the ACLU had a conflict and asked me to indicate that ACLU is in opposition to this bill. As you heard, this bill would increase the mandatory minimum penalties on the listed offenses from 8 years and 4 months to 25 years. It also increases the post-prison supervision time to lifetime supervision if you've been convicted of one of the listed offenses. Needless to say, this would constitute a sea change in Oregon criminal justice, in our Oregon criminal justice system. Is it appropriate to initiate such a sea change in the waning days of the session when we haven't given this bill due consideration? Perhaps it is. I suggest it's not. It makes sense to give this issue the analysis that it deserves, and it does deserve analysis. There's some important questions we have to ask ourselves. Does it make sense to focus our resources on the worst of the worst? Absolutely. Absolutely does. I do commend the drafters of this bill for narrowly focusing the target, and that is some pretty bad people. It makes sense to focus, and they're focusing. That's good. Where do we get the resources that are going to be required to enact what is proposed? We suggest, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association suggests, the resources should come from the people who are not so dangerous. It makes sense when money is tight to redirect resources to the worst of the worst. Well, who are the people who are less dangerous? And we could perhaps not penalize as significantly as they're being penalized now. Well, I have some ideas. I could write down five now, but that's just my opinion. I'd like to know who those people are. Oregon Criminal Justice Commission could do such an analysis. An interim committee could do such an analysis. And I'll tell you all this right now. This is not a stall tactic. my organization will come to the table. We've talked, we didn't know about this, Phil, until a few days ago. We've talked recently about, you know, our clients, we see them every day, some 17 or 18-year-old who has consensual sex with a younger girlfriend, and they're hooked with registering as a sex offender. And we say, you know, is that person the same as someone who commits one of these listed crimes, yet they're both to have to register as a sex offender? Wouldn't it make more sense to be using our resources on those really bad people? And we know when we represent a really bad person, trust me, as well as the police know, perhaps sometimes better, we know the really bad ones, and it bothers us, and we see the not-so-bad ones caught up in that net of punishment. So we desperately do want to discuss this issue. I haven't seen the amendment even. I just got up to speed on the bill before I came in here, and now I understand there's an amendment. We ask that an interim committee analyze this. And I will say this. If one of these crimes occurs, that's one too many. And that goes without saying. But I do get a sense that the speed with which some people urge you to move is based on a belief that this is really getting bad out there. It's getting worse. It's bad now, but it's getting worse. I pulled numbers up this morning because I didn't know if it was getting worse. It's not getting worse. I'll turn this out. I'll hand these out. We need a chart. Oregon sex offenses. This is from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Most recent stats we have are 2003. The rate of sex offenses in Oregon is decreasing. So I don't point that out to say, see, we don't have a problem in Oregon. No, there's too many on that list. But I point it out to say, if we feel we need to act today because it's getting worse, it's not getting worse. This should be analyzed in the interim. What is getting worse is the coverage by TV news. There's no doubt about that. You flip on the TV, they're always reporting this. This is a topic that has caught their interest. So that is getting worse, but the numbers show Oregon sex offenses are decreasing. So in summary, we should focus on the worst of the worst. Who the worst of the worst is a question that needs to be analyzed. And where do we get the resources from is a question that needs to be analyzed. And we would love to be part of that such an analysis. Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hummel, I realize you haven't seen the amendment. We've only seen it here for a few minutes. But among the crimes that have specific mandatory minimum sentences applied to them are rape in the first degree, rape in the second degree, lawful sexual penetration in the first or second degree, sexual abuse in the first degree. Are those crimes that are limited to stranger kind of violence, which is what the sort of powerful testimony we heard earlier, or are those offenses that could be committed in the cases where the victim is known to the assailant?
Representative McPherson, no sex crime in Oregon is limited to strangers. You'll see the different classifications based on two primary features. One, the age of the victim, and two, whether or not force was used. You know, obviously, if the victim's younger, or if force is used, that will move you up the scale. But whether you're known to the assailant is not a category that can increase the offense.
Okay. And actually, a question that I wanted to pursue, Mr. Chair, with either can be Mr. Hummel or with counsel, is I don't have a sense about how these new mandatory minimums relate to Measure 11 mandatory minimums and or the sentencing grid that we have in place now. To what extent is this an enhancement of either Measure 11 mandatory minimums or the sentencing grid?
Since I have the amendments in front of me, I can go ahead and answer this. This is amending the statutory codification of ballot Measure 11. So these would be ballot Measure 11 mandatory minimum sentences. Rape and sodomy and unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree are what on the sentencing guidelines grid? Do you either? It's 10, probably.
It would be 10 or 9 or 10.
Okay. So they are on the sentencing guidelines grid, but of course Measure 11 would trump that. In this case, what it's doing, well, you looked like you had another question.
Are they all within Measure 11, all these offenses here?
Yes.
So that there's no really the sentencing grid then really isn't relevant because it isn't Measure 11 stiffer at all levels, or maybe it isn't for people who have extensive history.
Representative McPherson, there are times, though rare, where a DA may look to the sentencing guidelines grid, potentially an upward departure, a double upward departure, or something of that nature would carry with it a longer prison sentence than the mandatory minimum sentence would, in which case the DA may seek that. However, it's my understanding that let's say, for argument's sake, that using the sentencing guidelines rules, a DA could get 450 months for what is a 300-month sentence. They may try to do that, and then 300 months of that sentence would be mandatory minimum, no good time or earned time credits. The balance, the 150 months, would be eligible for some reductions.
Okay.
If that makes...
Okay, that does.
Okay.
And if a further question, though, how do these... where presumably all elevated mandatory minimums compare to the existing Measure 11 mandatory minimums.
Correct, Representative McPherson. What this bill does, and again, I'm going off of the Dash 1 amendments, which, as I understand it, is what the proponents actually preferred to the original bill. What this does is when the child victim is under 12 years of age, which, as you can see here in the Dash 1 amendments, as you look through, you'll see, for example, J, rape in the first degree is defined in 1A, C, or D. That's the one kind of rape, and that would get 100 months. If you look then on page 4 of the amendments, you'll see rape in the first degree as defined in 163.375.1B. That subsection 1B... is the victim is under 12 years of age subsection. So then you would take it up 200 months, essentially, if you rape, sodomize, or sexually penetrate a child victim under 12, you would have a 200-month increase in your mandatory minimum sentence.
So the increase is 200 months?
Yes, correct.
So let's see if I understand that. So are these numbers here then are the increment? I'm not following here. They're not the complete sentence. They're the incremental number of months.
If a person commits rape in the first degree, for example, mm-hmm. here, that would be under subsections A, C, or D.
Mm-hmm.
A is forcible compulsion. C is, I believe, 16 and under. No. Relative? Thank you. Yes, if it's a relative and they're 16 and under. D is inability to consent by virtue of mental disease or defect or incapacitation of some sort. So if you commit rape in the first degree of these three varieties, you would get 100 months.
That's not the incremental sentence. That's the total sentence.
That's your total sentence.
Right.
If,
okay.
on the other hand, you rape a child under 12 years of age, you're going to get 300 months. Same statute. They're just taking out 1B, and then they're putting it in there.
I see.
And likewise with the sodomy and the sexual
penetration. I was having trouble reading where it's bold, which is the new language.
Right.
So it's the existing is the 100 months.
Correct.
And so this would become 300 months.
Yes.
Okay. And... 300.
That's what I want to think about.
That's 300 months is a lot of time. Yeah, 25 years.
There
it is. My rough calculation here.
That's
okay, I think I understand the mechanics of the bill then. Good. Thank you.
Okay, anything further comments?
Mr. Cromwell, I'm sorry. Hummel.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. My apologies. I'm not hearing you, if I'm hearing you correctly, I'm not hearing you say that an adult sexually assaulting an 11-year-old, because they're under 12, I don't hear you saying you have a big problem with us getting draconian on that, but what you're talking about is, if we're going to do that as part of a package, we ought to be looking at what may not be such a serious person, shifting some of that funding, for example, the teenagers that are caught having sex, and the guy's 18, the girl's, whatever, 16.
And instead of having them on the track, so we're really looking at the more serious criminals. And, of course, anybody raping an 11-year-old is a serious, I think everybody would pretty much agree, I hope, that that's a pretty serious crime.
Representative Barker, thank you for the question. First, I have not seen the amendment, so I have to tread somewhat cautiously here. But my statement that my organization is willing to look at increased penalties in one area if we have an offset in another area, that was a package proposal. We wouldn't accept one standing alone. So if we would definitely consider that. And one interesting point to consider about the age difference, while initially at first blush, if you say, you know, if someone's under 12, if the victim's under 12, let's drop the hammer, that's bad. It's less bad if the defendant is 14 as opposed to them, the defendant is.
In this bill, maybe it's in the amendments, the offender is 18 or
okay.
older.
I haven't seen that, so that does make a difference. Thank you.
Just so you know, Mr. Hummel, the original bill amended both 137, 700, and 707.
Correct.
This only amends 700.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Dole, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. We are very much in support of this bill. I think that it's incumbent upon us to realize that despite how some may want to characterize what the responsibilities of government are, the number one responsibility of government is to protect its citizens, and particularly to protect its children. Let's be clear. I'm going to say this one more time because I heard a lot of misinformation. This is first-degree rape, first-degree sodomy, first-degree unlawful penetration perpetrated by a person who is over the age of 18 on a person who is under the age of 12. Let's be clear about that. Yeah, there has been a lot in the news. I'm not sure. I heard Mr. Hummel said the numbers are going down. Well, the numbers are actually jumping around. If you look at this, in 2000 we were at 5896. In 2001 we were at 5710. In 2002 we jumped to 5945. And in 2003, thank God, we're down a little bit again at 5867. I'll tell you what's driving the Measure 11 population. It's sex crimes. 44% of the people that are in on Measure 11 offenses are sex offenders. Now, we've made modifications to that. We've taken some of the sex offenders out of Measure 11. But I have to tell you this, in all due respect to Mr. Hummel, public safety and sentencing shouldn't be a zero-sum game. It certainly isn't in other parts of government, and it's not going to be in public safety. 18 states have tough laws, like we're proposing here today, on child sex offenders. Another 9 states are looking at increasing their penalties for child sex offenders. The public is fed up. They've had enough. There's been too many Jessica Lunfords. There's been too many Shasta and Dilligronis. And as Representative Cameron very well put it, we don't want to wait until we have to name it after some child in Oregon. We just want this to be the Oregon Child Sexual Assault Protection Act. We don't want to have a Jessica or a Lisa or a Barbara or a Steve or a whoever. We don't want that. The devastation and destruction that is brought upon young people, children, when they are sexually assaulted is vast. But let's just think about some of it. Alcoholism, drug use, anger management problems, especially with little boys who are abused and raped, domestic abuse, another problem with men, promiscuity, depression, sexual dysfunction, going out and committing crimes. I know personally a woman who had children who were sexually assaulted while she was going to law school. The boy ended up in prison, not for sex offenses, but for burglaries and drug crimes. And also, yes, some of them, although the figures are overblown, some of them go on to become sexual abusers themselves. Somewhere we've got to stop this. And I say the first time is the last time. Thank you very much, and I'd appreciate, I'll take any of your questions. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Committee members, do you have any questions? Okay, thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
That's all we had signed up on the bill, and we do need to move along, but Representative Smith and Cameron, would you take time to talk to Bill Taylor? He has some suggestions. And I had a conversation, I believe, earlier with you about an interim work group that we're going to look at the situation. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3507. And we're going to drop back, clear up on top to HJR 18. Open the hearing work session. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair. House Joint Resolution 18.
The amendment.
Yes, specifically the amendments which are being handed out would replace the measure and would amend the Oregon Constitution to modify eligibility for veterans' farm and home loans upon approval by voters. The measure would refer the question to voters at the May 2006 primary election. Makes active members of the Oregon National Guard and Reserves eligible if they have completed their initial active status obligation, and authorizes refinancing and also clarifies eligibility of veterans' spouse. The amendments, the dash one amendments are a complete copy of HJR 47A, which was dealt with by the Veterans Affairs Committee in April and May.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Just
for the record, so you know, Veterans Committee sent this out unanimously to Rules and Elections, and simple error. We frankly lost place of it on the list, and when Rules and Elections closed, it was still in Rules and Elections. And so what we're trying to do is resurrect it, because we need this to keep our veteran home loan program moving. And I believe the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs can address that issue specifically. And this just happened to be the menu we had available to us to move it.
Okay, thank you. Paula Brown here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I have with me here today Bruce Shriver. If there are questions of him or if he provides testimony, he can identify himself for the record. I'm pleased to be here today to testify on House Joint Resolution 18 with the Dash 1 amendments. HJR 18 was not included in the Governor's 2005-07 recommended budget. If HJR 18 with the Dash 1 amendments is successfully passed by the Oregon Legislature and receives a favorable vote by the citizens of Oregon, then Article 11A of the Oregon Constitution would be amended to allow certain Oregon National Guard service members, reservists, and certain surviving spouses to be eligible for a State of Oregon Veterans Home Loan. Presently, this valuable housing benefit is generally available only to those men and women who have served on active duty in the armed forces of the United States and have been honorably discharged, separated, or released from active duty. During the legislative session, the department was approached and requested to work with the Oregon Military Department on possible amendments to Article 11A of the Oregon Constitution. The department also sought technical input from nationally recognized bond and tax counsel, as well as the Oregon Department of Justice. HJR 18 with the Dash 1 amendments, which previously, as the committee administrator indicated, was HJR 47, would accomplish what was intended. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, and I guess so veterans knows too, the implement, there was a companion House bill which has actually been already put into another bill elsewhere, and so the implementation language, should this pass, is already in the process and the chain somewhere else. And again, this was an error. I would call your attention, which you might not know, there was, quote, a fiscal, but it was from 47, which I think totaled $16,974, which why there is not a referral. It would simply go on the next ballot that was out there that's appropriate.
If I could add, Mr. Chair, that fiscal statement, I'm sorry, I did not have time to make copies of that. It would reflect the cost of adding that to the voter's pamphlet.
Okay. Cool. Does he want to testify?
My testimony.
Do you have any testimony?
Mr. Chair, no. I was just here in case there were technical questions.
This is an opportunity for me just to indulgence of the committee, just a little bit of education. I'm sort of vaguely aware of the Veterans Home Loan Program, but I don't understand really just how it works. There are state funds that are, I assume, backed by the full faith and credit of the state then that are available, that support mortgages that are taken out currently by federal armed forces veterans, and this would expand it to the National Guard. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, yes, the way the Home Loan Program works is the department issues tax-exempt general obligation bonds. By being tax-exempt, they end up being lower-cost bonds, and so we pass on, and then we take those funds and then lend them out to eligible veterans in the state of Oregon, and they end up generally with a lower interest rate on their home mortgage.
Can you identify yourself?
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bruce Shriver. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you. If I could, and Mr. Shriver, we're in a period of historically low mortgage rates, and which are, I mean, even just to the general public, are extraordinarily low. How much lower does a veteran's loan end up being than what generally is available in the marketplace?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, traditionally it's ranged between a half to a half a percent to a full percent. Right now we're about 0.375% below market.
Okay, and if I could, Mr. Chair, what's the standard kind of percentage of appraised value and duration, and is it a fixed interest rate loan? What's some of the mechanics of the loan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, the loans are fixed rate loans. Under present law, you can lend up to 97% loan to value ratio. Although Senate Bill 223 was passed and signed by the governor, which will become effective January 1st, and that loan to value ratio could then actually go up to a 100% loan to value. However, the key thing to keep in mind here as far as protecting the state's interest is that any loan with a loan-to-value ratio in excess of 80% requires mortgage insurance on it.
I'm sorry. Mortgage insurance, that is life insurance
It protects the state in case of a default, in case the borrower stops making their payment, and then we have to foreclose on that property.
So there are insurers who will write that risk, that is the risk of default, by the borrower.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Representative McPherson.
But presumably we have to pay something for that insurance, right? Who issues such a policy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, the borrower pays for that.
I see. Okay. And just, I think the last one, just to clarify, and this, the effect of this HJR 18-1 would be to expand the eligibility for the program from, I was tracking this right, from just the what we think is the regular sort of national armed forces to include the state National Guard. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, yes. Under current law, you had to have served on active duty and been discharged. What this amendment would do would be to expand the eligibility to those guardsmen and reservists who complete their initial active status obligation. But, and those, so those people may not have been mobilized to full active duty service, but may have just served in the National Guard for a six-year period of time, you know, doing their drilling.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Just a couple of things, and to the benefit of Representative Barker over this, includes the Marine Corps Reserve too, but it includes all the reserve components. The problem that we found out that in recent years, and this committee has not been privy to this, and we've argued and debated, heard it, and everything else in Veterans Affairs, is the federal government, for whatever distinct reason, has come up with ways to skirt the veterans issue, and so therefore they consistently put people on what we call 179-day tours, and so therefore they're not qualified, quote, as a veteran, even though they've been mobilized in many cases. And the example I brought up, which was a good one, was we had Marine Corps soldiers from their version of SWAT teams, along with our SEALs, serving under my command in Mosul in a combat zone on annual training orders. They were basically there on 21 days annual training, weakling warrior, in the middle of a war zone. And what we found in the state of Oregon is consistently Guard soldiers, and to no fault of the military department, Marine Corps reservists, Coast Guard reservists, and everything else, being constantly called up and, in fact, sent over to the across the pond, but because of this quirk in the law, they're not qualified as veterans. And so here in the state of Oregon, we're trying to, you know, fix that. And if you recall, we passed unanimously out of the floor of the House, unanimously out of the Senate, and the governor signed a bill that got us back around that. We reduced ours to 178 days and a few other things so that we could get around the federal government, for better words, screwing over our citizen soldiers.
Interesting.
A question for you, Representative. Does this, if I was hearing right, this would extend it to everybody who signed up and then completed a tour, whether they ever went near a war zone? Basically, the traditional kind of weekend warrior who spends a weekend, a month, and a two-week summer tour would then be classified as a result of this bill as a veteran, whether they've been taken into a war zone and under a skirting of the rules by the federal government. Is that right?
For the most part, I believe that's technically correct, and of course the program is still limited by funding and everything else, and I think Deputy Director Brown may be able to address that on a better issue than I can.
Okay. Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, that's correct. One way to look at it, though, is that if you have an active duty service member, whether that active duty service member is actually deployed and serves in a combat zone, that veteran has veteran status and would be eligible to receive an Oregon State Veterans Home Loan. If you had a National Guard service member who was not deployed to the combat zone to have gotten the Campaign or Expeditionary Medal, but they did honorably serve and complete their initial obligation to the Guard, typically 6 years, they wouldn't have the veteran status. This change would allow them to have that veteran status, the same as an active duty person who serves stateside, perhaps, their entire active duty time, but not in a combat zone.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'm going to look for a nod from Representative or from Colonel Caldwell. I think traditionally it would be 6 years. I believe the obligation now is 8 years. Has not the obligation increased yet? So it would be someone historically who served 8 years, and I guess you could say weekend warriors for 6 years total, but now that minimum requirement is 8 years.
Okay. Well, I guess that actually triggers a question. And do they have to complete that tour before they would then be eligible, or if they're enrolled in a hitch that lasts that long, would that be sufficient?
I believe they actually have at least 6 years of that. And Colonel Caldwell, who is from the military department and kind of spearheaded this, may be able to address that if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. State your name for us, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. I thought I'd head out in the back of the room pretty much. Protected myself on this, but Representative Boquist is absolutely correct. Colonel enlistments are 8 years in total for all service members, whether they're active or guard or reserve. In our case, 6 years of those are in an active status, two of them are in an inactive status. And everybody who joins the military has that 8-year obligation. And whether or not they do, and right now, for instance, the Army does 15-month enlistment. They're still going to have an 8-year obligation, but they have a 15-month active duty enlistment. Time they get out of training, they got less than a year that they can be deployed to any place. So they're probably going to end up sitting somewhere in a, you know, who knows what will happen. But the point that I think was made by Deputy Director Brown is that for whatever reason, we have chosen to define and differentiate for the reserve component that there is a different level or a different level you have to meet in order to be qualified and or worthy of certain benefits, but yet on the active duty side, all you got to do is go sit and suck your thumb for 15 months and you'll get the same benefit. So we think that's a little bit ridiculous, and we brought that up to the Veterans Committee, and they did a very nice job, I think, of ferreting it out and coming up with this solution. So we're very pleased with that at this point. We support the bill wholeheartedly.
Further to that, to clarify, if you look on page 3 of the amendment, you'll see the operative clause. What identifies is that an individual has to serve their initial 6-year term unless, of course, they are disabled with a service-connected disability from that, and then they're at which point then they're a disabled veteran and qualify otherwise.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the -1 amendments into House Joint Resolution 18.
Representative Boquist has moved the -1 amendments in HJR 18. The objections to the motion of the amendments? So adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Joint Resolution 18 as amended to the floor with a do-adopt.
Be adopted.
Be adopted.
Representative Boquist has moved HJR 18 be adopted to the floor. Call the roll.
Representative Burgess?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. HJR 18 moves to the floor, and Representative Boquist, you can be the carrier. Close the work session. Open a work session on Senate Bill 501A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. A little hurry here, please pass. Oh, excellent. Okay. Senate Bill 501A requires that the insurance carriers provide annual reports to the Department of Consumer and Business Services on the total number of members, the total premiums, the total amount of costs for claims, medical loss ratio, average premium amounts paid by each member per month, and a percentage of the change between the premiums from the previous year to the current year. It also requires that that report include aggregate financial information from preceding years of total amounts of the general administrative expenses, surpluses maintained, reserves maintained for unpaid claims, new underwriting gains or losses, and the net income after taxes. Mr. Chair, we also have a -A7 amendment attached to your staff measure summary, which adds to the bill the requirement for an insured over 50 years of age that a health insurance policy must cover an annual colorectal exam as outlined in the bill. It establishes that this coverage is not subject to the 6th anniversary repeal, and it has an effective date of January 1, 2006.
Chair, I have a question of staff. Did you say the A7 is the only amendment?
That is, Mr. Chair.
We have Joe Ariel, John Powell, and Jessica Stevens come up, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ariel, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 501A. It moves forward on a very important priority in the health care world today, which is increased transparency so that consumers and other interested parties can better understand how the system works. And in this case, it focuses on insurer rate filings and insurer financial performance. Most of the data that was just described by your committee administrator is already in filings that we get, but it is oftentimes difficult to find this particular information in mounds of paper, and so the interested parties, the insurers and the some labor folks have worked zealously over the last several months to try to identify key indicators that would help consumers and other interested parties better compare insurers on their rate filings and on their financial performance, and we think this bill does make a step forward in making that whole process more transparent, so we support that. We are neutral on the A7 amendments, which is usually our position on new mandates. We do, though, strongly recommend the A7s over the A5s, because we think if we're going to have a new mandate, it ought not to be implemented immediately, but rather implemented as of January 1st of next year. So we certainly don't have any problem with the A7 amendments either. With that, I'll turn to one of my colleagues up here.
Sure. Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Stevens. I'm with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. We also support Senate Bill 501. We believe that if this bill passes, it will be for the first time that this information will be available by market segment and the first time that most of the information will be available to consumers on the Internet. Oregonians certainly can't afford the current trend in healthcare cost increases. Oregon's businesses, citizens, and taxpayers deserve some accountability. This bill will help give consumers additional tools to choose between between insurers, and it does represent a compromise, but one that makes sense for both consumers and the industry. In regard to the A7 amendments, we support the addition of that language to the bill and are certainly supportive of the implementation being in January instead of through an emergency clause.
Okay. Mr. Powell.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, our testimony is a little different in that we do support Senate Bill 501 as it came to you, and Jessica pointed out we've worked with her union to develop that reporting mechanism, and we fully support transparency of all the players in the healthcare delivery system, including the payer. And Senate Bill 501 provides a step toward that kind of transparency for consumers. However, we would not recommend the A7 amendments to you. However, I feel the presence of a colonoscope around my neck and my feet being pulled somewhere from the Senate President's office at this point in time. And if you've ever had one of those procedures, to have one anywhere on your body is not pleasant, let alone around your neck. We recommend against the legislature mandating policy provisions, because it takes away consumer choice. It does add to costs. There is one and only one reason people are uninsured almost exclusively, and that's costs. This does add costs. It's probably the one thing we can all agree on is that insurance, health insurance, is extremely costly, and it ends up costing some people all of their insurance. So we would not recommend that the legislature add yet another mandate. It also does not apply to self-insured groups. Under federal law, a state cannot regulate employee benefits, but you are, in this case, just regulating the insurer. So this falls on small business as opposed to large business. I have one large business insurance client, does business nationwide in this country. As of January 1 of 06, will go self-insured. And one of the reasons is the patchwork of mandates across the country. And it is getting so expensive that it really comes down to how many employees they can afford to hire to accomplish tasks that their business is in business to do. So with that, I would stop and answer any questions you might have.
Committee members, you have any questions of the panel? I'll leave you off easy. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Emergency clause is still in there. You lost me.
I think we'll have testimony.
Okay.
I think we'll hear testimony about that.
Well, let's hear that, and then we can confirm.
No one else?
That's all that we have signed up to testify.
You have a question?
I do have a question. I would like to have addressed.
Rosie Flores has a question of someone.
Who might it be?
Anyone that would care to answer it. Perhaps Mr. Powell could address it. Are you making other arrangements, Mr. Powell? In regard to the Dash 7 amendments and the implementation or the insertion of the emergency clause, do you have any comment on that?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, thanks to the Speaker's office, I was contacted by them yesterday and asked about the provisions of this amendment, and that was one of the things that spotted, and they arranged to have the A7s drafted with the Section 7 language changed to an implementation date of January 1, and that is very much preferable. Otherwise, what we would have to do is retroactively deal with these claims, and because the minute it is signed, it would become law. And so any procedure done after that would come under the Act. So it would be very cumbersome and costly to do it that way. This way we'll be able to amend the policy forms, file them with the department, get them in the policies that are renewed so that the policyholder has it, and we have an administrative procedure to handle the claims as they come in.
Senator Cruz, do you have something on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. You guys are famous. You're on TV. And I was watching. And we had a long discussion over Senate Bill 501 in the Senate Health Policy Committee. And a lot of work was put into that bill to make it something that I think probably at the end of the day is probably good public policy. We also had a long discussion and a bill on what is now the Dash A7 amendment. Now, whether you like that or not, keep in mind it is another mandate, and all mandates cost money. And we know that for every 1% increase in premium, about 3,000 people lose coverage in the state. That's hard figures, and you can't argue with that. But on top of that, I think, as I understood the A7 amendment, it removed the 6-year sunset, which we have on all other insurance mandates. Now, there's a couple reasons that we do that. One is it requires us to go back and look at what the mandate is, and it also gives us the opportunity to look at how technology and science has advanced over time to see if what we're mandating is still, because we mandate tests, we mandate procedures, and over time best science changes as to what procedures are. So Mr. Chair, I would have a very strong objection to removing the sunset. Why would we treat this different than the other mandates, the other 25 mandates we have on the books? And colleagues, I mean, you know, we go to a bigger picture. At some point in time, we're going to have to look at the way we deliver health care in a more global way, because it's becoming more unaffordable for the average Oregonian over time. Adding things that make sense at a point in time sounds good, but you got to look at what the total impact is. So, Mr. Chair, if indeed you are going to add this piece, and I will object to this being done you know, when an issue is discussed and vetted in one chamber, then comes over to the other chamber and has other things not necessarily related to the issue added to it, I find that problematic, especially when the other issue is a standalone issue with its own bill. But if indeed it's the committee's pleasure to do that, I would ask that you consider waiting until you could have an amendment that puts the sunset back in. And I'd answer any questions.
Any questions, committee? Staff? You have any? I might have a question. They removed the sunset dates on some of the procedures for some of the women's.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that did happen over my objections, and it's, you know, it's quite simply, if you look at all the mandates that we currently have on the books, and if we were to do a really thorough job of vetting all those things, most of them would probably come off the books because they, over time, they tend to become standard covered practices anyway. But we have mandated them for one reason or another. But at some point in time, insurance is becoming, as it becomes increasingly unaffordable because we are covering absolutely everything conceivable, we're going to need to look at a different way of financing health care in the state. And so, to a degree, just adding more mandates is exacerbating a problem that so far we, as a policy body, haven't had the courage or the wisdom to truly look at and try to find another way to do business. But you're right, Mr. Chairman, we did do that. I'm not sure that was good policy either.
Mr. Powell, you said that you had what was a comment you made about the President of the Senate?
Mr. Chairman, as I understand Senate Bill 374, which is being put into Senate Bill 501, belongs to the Senate President. Mm-hmm. It was his bill.
And we sort of kind of have marching orders?
That's what I understand. That's what I felt. I have that funny feeling that there's a...
There are a few people up here who also have marching orders.
That's what I mean. I was trying to give you a wink that you could understand.
Yeah. And I have to agree with Senator Cruz that mandates do cost. But maybe if we added up the costs and the fact that we have people's health taken care of earlier and it doesn't develop into a much larger problem, maybe there's as close to much saving for the insurers and the ratepayers as there is if we had some of these things go forward.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, that's an issue that could be debated, and I also understand who the players are, trust me. I don't think adding a sunset changes the intent or the application of this mandate.
Okay, any questions or comments of these gentlemen? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I move the A7 amendments into Senate Bill 501.
Representative Boquist has moved the A7 amendments into Senate Bill 501. Objections? Any objections to the motion? The amendments therein?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 501 to the floor as amended.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 501 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Comments? Objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 501A has amended moves to the floor with a due pass.
Okay. That's fine.
And Representative Boquist will carry. And we'll close the work session with that.
And I'm going to open a work session on a public hearing on Senate Bill 1080. Sandy, you're going to explain it?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 180 requires that the laboratory performing a water sample analysis for a water supplier to report those results of the analysis directly to the Department of Human Services and to the water supplier if the analysis shows contaminant levels in excess of established levels by the department allowed by the water quality department. Sorry on that. That's grammar.
Thank you. Questions of staff? If not, I'm going to ask that Gail Shibley and Amanda Rich come forward. Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems, what some of you may know as used to be called the Oregon Health Division. It is part of the Department of Human Services. Amanda Rich was not sure she was going to be able to make it today, so I don't know that we will see her in person to voice her support on behalf of the organizations she represents. I'm passing out some written testimony as well as kind of a visual aid that is an excerpt of a much larger audit report that was done and published in January of 2001. I will not read the testimony, and I won't go into any more detail than you absolutely would like. This is what I might characterize as kind of a 2% solution for perhaps a 2% problem. What this audit identified for us as folks who are concerned about protecting public drinking water in the state is that we are not getting all of the results that we need to get in order to immediately and effectively assist water suppliers in correcting problems and protecting public health. The audit found that a number of systems did not report results of tests that that exceeded public health standards, for example, for lead and copper, for inorganic chem tests, for coliform bacteria or other chemical contamination. As the saying goes, we can't solve a problem that we don't know about. This bill would allow us to get to work earlier and we think more effectively, more efficiently, and protect public health. Current statute does not allow laboratories to send results to public health authority unless the water supplier directs them to. This bill would change that in a narrowed couple of exceptions. For tests that are required under EPA public health compliance schedule, once those results are validated that and show that in fact there's a problem with the water supply, there's a problem with as a result of the test from that sample, the sooner we know about it, the sooner we can get to work on it. And the original language that has been proposed, I think, last session in both the House and the Senate was not supported by the water suppliers, not supported by the utilities and so on. This language that you've got in front of you is the result of consensus and compromise and discussion by a number of the stakeholders, and includes the Special District Association, testing laboratories, state and local public health departments, and municipalities. And this eliminates the main deficiency that was identified in the audit while minimizing any additional burden. The practical effect is that very few test results need to be sent directly to us, because the good news is Oregon has pretty good drinking water. And in fact, an analysis of the test results that we do have show that something like 2% of all bacteria tests exceed the maximum contaminant load limits. Results for chemicals is significantly less than that. So we kind of call this the 2% solution for a 2% problem. The problem's not great, but it's significant when and as it happens. And so we want we are satisfied with this language that really more surgically gets at the issue. This bill had strong bipartisan support in the Senate, both in committee as well as on the House side, and I certainly encourage this committee to pass it to the floor as well.
Questions, committee members? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 1080. And I'm going to open a work session on SB 303. And Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a public hearing on Senate Bill 303 on June 14th. At that time, we heard from Rocky King of the Insurance Pool Governing Board. As you recall, Senate Bill 303 abolishes the Insurance Pool Governing Board and establishes and renames that office to the Office of Private Health Partnerships. The bill outlines the many transferring of functions and responsibilities. At that time, we do have a fiscal impact. However, the impact indicates that it just provides additional comments of the structure from the old office into the new office. There is no financial or fiscal impact. We do have, and I have, there is a dash one amendment attached to the staff measure summary that I'm just now passing down to you. That amendment, currently the Insurance Pool Governing Board is authorized to provide and distribute aggregate data for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. The department or the agency has other programs that requirement needs to be expanded to, so the amendment adds the language other agency programs to be included in that authority. Also, Mr. Chair, before our hearing, we were notified that the original bill, Senate Bill 303, has conflicts. And conflict amendments will be coming. They could not get them done to us before our 1 o'clock timeline.
Okay, what I want to do is move the dash ones in so they can be part of the conflict discussion, and then we'll have the conflict amendments looked at and bring it back probably Tuesday, if we can.
And as a follow-up, in that motion on Tuesday, we did get approval from the Speaker to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Hey, Ms. Chair, I'd like to move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 303.
I have a question. Move the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 303. Any objections? Not therein. And we'll close the work session on 303. And we're going to go back and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1080.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1080 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1080 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Yeah, we can do that. Senate Bill 1080 moves to the floor. The due pass, and we will put it on the consent calendar. That'll make it easy. I believe we're finished for the day, and I think we're back Tuesday. And I think they're going to schedule us about 11 o'clock.
11?
Yeah, that way we can move sooner or later or postpone, depending on what they do with floor session.
Mm-hmm.
And we're done for the day. Thank you.
Floor session's 4.
No, that's
Monday.
Or on Tuesday. I'm sorry.
Thank you.